whereas, say, an American would look at foreground in a picture.
This is a very well-established fact. As I was preparing to write these lectures, you know, I did say something to a psychologist friend about, boy, you know, I hope this isn't too inflammatory and controversial. And she said, there's nothing controversial here. You know, you are standing on a mountain of evidence. It's not a little evidence. It's a mountain of evidence. And the mountain suggests that with this cultural difference in how the self is shaped, we place our focus differently. And literally, we construct different worlds as a result. Again, I'm talking about in general, many, many, many exceptions, many over, you know. But in general, people with a more interdependent point of view tending to focus on the context, and people with an independent point of view tending to focus on the inside, right? So if they look at a picture of a lion in the savannah, European Americans will tend to see the object, meaning the lion, and other people will tend to see the savannah. In my book, I do cite a very striking study that was done on elderly Singaporean men, in which they were shown a series of pictures in which the foreground object was changed in a way which seems very dramatic to European Americans. So the foreground object was changed from a vacuum to a plant to a guitar, you know, so this kind of change, only to have their fMRIs show no sign of their registering anything whatsoever, whereas when they were shown a picture of a bird against the background where the background was changed in a way that can seem subtle to European Americans, they registered that just fine. I should really point out that, you know, if told to focus on the object, they could. It's not that they couldn't. It's that they habitually focused on the context.
It's kind of unconscious at that point.
Absolutely. It's habitual. And I will say, too, that, you know, if you ran the same study on elderly European Americans, I'm very sure that you would see the exact opposite phenomenon, which is that they would register the object just fine, but would have to really kind of concentrate in order to register the environment or the context.
So, say, two pictures would be a picture of a bird in a room and a picture of a penguin in a room, and the room was the same, the Singaporeans would say, they'd see the room, they'd say no change.
Right, exactly.
Right. Whereas if you had a bird in the sky versus a bird flying in a room,
right,
the Europeans would say no change.
Yeah, European Americans.
European Americans.
Yes,
yeah.
And I mean, of course, we're talking about the extreme now, right?
Right.
Because
yeah,
we're talking about, you know, very elderly people in their 90s, you know, but they point to a general truth, and the general truth is that people with an individualistic outlook tend to focus on objects. Discrete objects. They prefer to see discrete objects. It's the world that they construct.
I'm Richard Walensky. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and my guest is Gish Jen. This is considered a, quote, memoir or
yes,
about your writing, yet it would appear, since you're talking about a thesis, this is actually an example of an interdependent book.
Yes, it's a very interdependent book. Well, it is an independent slash interdependent book. I myself am a hybrid person, you know, a changeling person. So I am a person who grew up in a highly interdependent household because my parents were Chinese immigrants. But I'm also a person who grew up in a very independent culture. So, you know, I have both selves, which is true, I will say, of many, many people today, probably, you know, in an increasing number of people today with globalization. My situation is not unusual, but it is true that, you know, in sitting down, you know, I was asked for the Massey Lectures at Harvard, I was asked to think about an intellectual autobiography. And, you know, for me, a very natural way of writing an intellectual autobiography was to write something which was about myself and yet also very much about my context at the same time. And I think you can see the way that there's a way in which my own story is definitely like kind of a through thread through the whole thing. It's like a crochet hook, if you will. You know, I'm pulling this thread all the way through the book. And yet the book ranges very widely. It includes my father's memoir. It includes a lot of literary analysis. Also, it includes many cognitive studies. But there is a through thread. I mean, if you ask, is this a book without a strong sense of self or something, that's absolutely not the case. There's a very strong sense of self. However, I think that for an intellectual autobiography, it is striking in the number of interdependent elements that it also includes.
Let's talk a little about the autobiography, and it comes up in the second half of the book, in the last two lectures, the relationship of the novel and fiction and your novels and fiction to this theory of the interdependent and the independent selves. So can you talk a little about those two strands, both in terms of the history of the novel, which means we can go back to the earliest tale of Genji versus, say, Tom Jones?
You know, Milan Kundera, I do quote in my book, and he wrote his book, The Art of the Novel, and he talks about, you know, how the novel's focus changes as we move from Don Quixote to Emma Bovary, and the focus, you know, moves from the external to the internal, until he says, Europe's finest illusion, that of the irreplaceable value of the self, blossoms forth, something like that. I'm mangling that a bit. These are not the words of a diehard individualist, you know. Right. I mean, this is somebody who really does feel that the idea that the individual is this very, very important and unique thing is an illusion, right? Again, to complicate the picture a little bit more, what you will see is that not only is the extreme individual that we see in the novel today, in the Western novel in America, is that unusual if we look at it geographically worldwide, but you can also see over time that actually the Western novel, even in the Western tradition, was not always this individualistic. It's really a relatively recent phenomenon. John Demos wrote a very interesting book called Circles and Lines. He actually documents the moment at which, you know, the early American colonists went from being quite interdependent to being suddenly very independent. They could see this actually because they would write notes in the almanacs, you know. And so up to a certain point, all the notes were about providence, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and they were relatively terse. And then suddenly you had this blossoming forth where people were starting to write about themselves and their experiences, so much so that the almanac makers had to add extra pages. So people, you know, were beginning to use them as diaries, basically. So you can sort of see that it has changed over the course of the novel. It has changed even in the United States.
Your books, and most novels, in fact, are about a hybrid of the two, right?
Yeah, I do think that I represent a hybrid, and I have some very good company, I will say. For instance, I think if we look at a work like War and Peace, a couple of years ago, James Wood of The New Yorker wrote an article about War and Peace, and you know, he picked out one feature after the next that seemed to him as kind of unconventional or weird about War and Peace. And there are things, you know, that he includes those big essays, right? Rather than dramatize things, he tends to kind of round the drama. It ends on kind of a very domestic note. It ends with a sense of routine, so a routine established. Many of these things, which Wood points out, are all hallmarks of the interdependent. And so I think that when we think about Tolstoy, if we think about him through this framework, what we're looking at is actually his Europeanness kind of blended with his Russianness.
Let's go back to Tale of Genji or another ancient or older text from the East.
An example would be Story of the Stone.
Okay.
You know, so we say the Story of the Stone was written by Sal Chuichin, but in fact, he would circulate his manuscript. You know, all his friends were all rewriting portions of it. There was not one text, actually. So, you know, there would be like many, many, many versions of the text because many different people were rewriting, commenting on different parts, you know. You know, the commentary was actually always considered an important part of the text. Subsequent generations, when people wanted a copy of Story of the Stone, they wanted it with all the annotations. So this whole idea that we have in the West that, you know, there's kind of an authentic text, you know, that we want to have the text that represents this man's vision is completely not applicable to the Story of the Stone. It isn't that at all. It is a great work. It's a work that has stood the test of time. And yet it is not the product of one man's vision, one man's imagining, one man's heart. It's not an expression of his uniqueness. It isn't any of those things. And nobody reading it is looking for that. I mean, in the East, when they read it, if we could somehow go back to, you know, the exact words that Cao Shuichin wrote, that's not the question that the audience is asking. They don't care. I guess one way of saying that is that, you know, the question of authenticity is a very different question in the East than it is in the West. We see evidence all the time. You know, Zaha Hadid right now is putting up a building in Beijing. And of course, it's being, you know, knocked off immediately in Chongqing. The knockoff is going up so fast, it may be up before the original. But the whole idea of an original, of that being some kind of a sacred thing, is not an Eastern idea. It's not an interdependent idea. If we ask ourselves, why do we think it's sacred? It's because we think it is a reflection of a unique person, and that's what makes it important, and that should be protected, you know, at all costs.
You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. I'm Richard Walensky, and joining me is Gish Chen. We put links on againstthegrain.org to her new book, Tiger Writing, and to her personal website. Gish Chen, this actually kind of moves in the direction of mashups.
Yes.
And collage.
Absolutely. I think that people from a very interdependent point of view have no problem with mashups and collage. If you think about Chinese painting, we see this very clearly. You know, so you can have, you know, a great Song Dynasty masterpiece like Fan Kuan's Travelers Among Mountains and Streams that I talk about in my book. He is clearly copying, if you will, the work of an early master, Li Cheng, right? And then his work was copied again and again and again and again throughout the century, right up till today. You know, he would not have had any problem with that, you know? I mean, if we copy the Mona Lisa here in the West, we feel that there's something, you know, that's kitsch. Two very different approaches to art and to creativity. Both are very creative. I mean, you look at the Fan Kuan, this is clearly a masterpiece. This is clearly great. And yet it is coming from a self which is diametrically opposed, really, to the self that dominates, certainly in present-day America. We have definitions of art where art is, of course, the product of an individual, and we value it to the degree that it reflects individualism. We're also sort of saying that people who are individualistic are more human than people who are collectivist. And yet, I think if you look at, you know, the products of the interdependent self, there is no way that you can say that they are actually lesser. If we look at a person, is the thing that is most important about the person the fact that they are different than any other person? I'm not sure that is the most important thing, because I'm a hybrid person, you know. I think that is sometimes the most important thing about a person, but sometimes it isn't. And I will say one thing that's very interesting about my father's autobiography. My father was a very singular man. I have never met anybody else like him, and I'm sure that no one who has ever been in contact with him has ever thought that, oh my God, he's just like a million other people. And yet my father did not much emphasize his uniqueness. He simply did not think it was the most important thing about him. He never talked about ways in which he was different than others. I think if we look at the interdependent self, you know, we're going to see the same range as you do in the independent self. You're going to see many people who are not very different than others. Then we're going to see outliers who are quite different than others. What's different is how that's viewed. So is it great to be an outlier from an interdependent point of view? Well, depends on what and how useful the outlier is, you know. From an independent view, to be an outlier is a great thing, right?
It would basically depend upon your frame of reference.
Exactly. And I guess in a general kind of way, I'm trying to bring attention to the frames of reference, with which we view and judge the world.
Yes, Jen, let's talk a little about how this relates to your own work, because it does tend to unfold as I'm looking at each of your novels, which all deal with basically the nature of identity,
yes,
whatever it might be. Who am I?
Right.
What am I in terms of that hyphen between Asian American, African American, Jewish American, European American, and how that relates to my family and to the world at large?
This is a question that we could discuss endlessly, probably, and on many, many different levels. But, you know, one of the things that I've been very interested in all along has been kind of the mutability of identity. And of course, that's very interdependent. I mean, I see it now, you know, from the beginning, I was very interested not in how to be a pure Asian American, to go back to my roots. I had never had the idea that the closer to my roots I could get, you know, the better, more authentic I would be, right? From the very beginning, you know, I was really interested in, you know, what does it mean to become an American? You know, that word become has always been very important to me. Why can't a Chinese American become a Jewish American, right? So my books are always about people. People are always changing identities. And now that I've written my lectures, I myself realize that some of that interest or, you know, kind of comfort with changing identities has to do with the interdependent part of me where, you know, I never had this stance where I was looking for some one truth within. It always seemed to me that things could change. You know, if you think about in that way, it's in line with many Eastern religions, for instance, Buddhism or Hinduism. You know, you can kind of see that emphasis on morphing, the comfort with morphing. Interestingly, I did bring that to the American context.
At what point did this hit you? When you were writing the lectures, did it gradually come to you over time?
Yeah, as I was writing the lectures, I began to see more and more in my work that I could see was interdependent. And partly was the morphing thing. There's a lot of emphasis on typicality in telling a story. Somebody from a more interdependent background will tend to talk about what's routine and everyday rather than what's extraordinary. So it goes along with that emphasis. It's kind of an aesthetic or a narrative equivalent of focusing on the background and the general rather than the exceptional and the object, right? So they tend to tell those stories in a way that emphasizes the typical. And then sure enough, I looked down at my first novel and there it was, typical American, you know? I see many elements what you're interdependent. Although I've got to say, you know, I am a hybrid. There's just no question about it.
Yes, Jen, fiction, it seems to me, by the fact that you're creating it, would tend to be an independent action.
Well, that's absolutely right. And, you know, I'm sure the fact that it is so independent is exactly why my parents were so opposed to my becoming a writer. You know, partly because it was risky, it was just terra incognita. But also, yeah, you know, I mean, somebody who sits down to write for, you know, months on end by themselves, I mean, that's a very independently oriented person. You know, when I say, you know, I've said many times that, you know, I am a hybrid, and I mean, I really am a true hybrid. Of course, now that I'm out on the road with this book and everybody wants to know, well, you know what I mean? I think people from a very strongly independent background are beginning to feel, you know, the shortcomings of that. And I think there's a tendency to romanticize the interdependent. Of course, people from a very interdependent background tend to romanticize the independent, you know, and everybody wants to know, well, you know, which side am I on since I know both? And I would have to say that it seems to me that in the best of all possible worlds, that we would be able to shift, you know, that we would have both the independent self and the interdependent self, and that we would be able to use both. Analysis, you know, that deep looking at one thing, the analytical frame of mind has been incredibly powerful. For people who, you know, who romanticize the interdependent, I feel like, well, I don't know, you know, I don't know where we would be without analysis, you know. At the same time, you know, anyone who's been in a Western hospital can tell you that the interdependent outlook, which is more holistic, you know, as I keep on saying, it focuses on the whole picture, not an isolated picture. There are many times where, you know, a holistic outlook is going to yield the most relevant truth. So to me, if you just look at that one example, you can sort of see we need both. We need both.
It seems to me that because of the emphasis on the independent self and capitalism in America and the power of the, if you want to call it, Republican Party propaganda, that a lot of people are going to romanticize the interdependent self because they're being overwhelmed by these ghastly images of what we see as the worst elements of the independent self.
I think that individualism in America has reached a level which is completely unprecedented in the history of the world. And I do think it's reached a point where it is dysfunctional. And again, it's not everyone. Look, Obama ran on, you know, we're all in this together. That's a very interdependent message, and he did win. You know, psychologists have actually shown that extreme individualism can produce an actual bias, an actual measurable bias, which you would have to say is an actual distortion in your apprehension of objective reality. The first study, you can tell when this was done by my example, they took a group of people and they randomly assigned them pro and anti-Castro positions. Objectively, the positions the people were assigned were not theirs. I mean, they might have been theirs, but anyway, they were randomly assigned these positions. They all wrote essays. And then the essays were shown to various people. And then they told them the truth. which is that the essays did not represent the writer's real opinions. They simply wrote those things because they were told to. And people from European backgrounds readily accepted this. You know, they said, oh, sure, okay, I see. They were told to write it, so they wrote it, you know. But people from a European-American background, that's to say highly individualistic, had a lot of trouble accepting what we know to be the objective truth about the situation. And that is because in their worldview, what was within was so determining of what happened or what one did, it was very hard to them to accept that something external could be strong enough, would have enough force to make a person behave in a way that was counter to what was internal. It's just an idea that they had about the world. This is called the fundamental attribution bias. And, you know, this is a very well-documented thing. I do think sometimes looking at America, I wonder how many people are exhibiting this bias and how bad it's gotten.
Gishchen, you do cover several other topics in the book. I recently interviewed David Shields. I mentioned to him that a lot of writers that I've talked to over the years talk about how characters write themselves. And he said that's hogwash. He said characters don't write themselves. That's a trope that writers have been saying for years. You mentioned a little bit about characters writing themselves in the book, Tiger Writing. Can you go into your own feelings about that idea and how that might relate to what we've been talking about?
You know, I am a hybrid writer, and I will say that my characters do write themselves. I don't think anybody really knows, you know, where the characters come from. But a psychoanalyst once told me that they were my internalized objects. You know, I don't know if that's true or not. You know, I do know that with a good character, you know, you do kind of follow them with a kind of Geiger counter, and you can feel it when you're getting a good signal from them, and you just follow the signal, and they absolutely are writing the book. That's on the first draft. And then, of course, on later drafts, you know, you might notice something about the character and you might, you know, you might shape them a little bit. It's not like it only comes from one part of your brain. But I think that, you know, when we had this feeling that a piece of narrative fiction is live, you know, I think the character is writing itself, you know. And frequently, not always, but frequently, the character is transgressive in some way. And, you know, and maybe this is going to just muddy my thesis, but I will say that I think, it, very interestingly, although the story of the stone was written in this very interdependent way, I mean, it could not be more interdependent. And literally, readers would just write all over the manuscript, you know. So, you know, literally, you know, very, very interdependent. And yet, there are characters in it which were clearly transgressive and clearly just really, you know, the main male protagonist is somebody who was really not on the Confucian program, I mean, at all. And there's no question in my mind that one of the reasons that people are so drawn to it today is because he was quite the character. Not about the method of composition, but the character himself was quite individualistic. You know, he represented a kind of feeling that many people had, a kind of resentment of Confucianism, a resentment of the social strictures, you know, and a desire for freedom from all that. It was somehow embodied in this character. So it's a very interesting thing, though, to see something arise that has such an independent cast, although the book was written in such an interdependent way.
Your second novel, Mona in the Promised Land, I use that as an example. Here you have a character, a strong character, who's making decisions about her life, and those decisions fall through. In that one, how much does the character influence the story, and how much control did you, Gishchen, have over the story, or is that the wrong question to ask?
Well, it's a little bit the wrong question to ask. I mean, I think that, you know, every writer has a different way of working. And so it's a little bit like chess. You know, if you ask, you know, everyone's playing the same game, but if you really scan people's brains while they're playing chess, they're not using the same, they're not playing the same game. They're using different parts of the brain. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's true of the novel also. So in the end, we all have beginning, middle, end. We do kind of require that, some kind of progression in the Western novel. But boy, there's a lot of ways of getting there. In my case, you know, I always think about what Gertrude Stein said about the artist. You know, she said the artist works by locating the world in himself. Of course, we women writers all wish that she had said herself, not art. That's not what she said. I think it's true. I think that that we have all developed nerves, as you know, sensitivities as a result of our contact with the world, and that for me, my working method is to try to locate those nerves and then follow them out. And then, sure enough, if you're on a world, you're on a nerve like that. Sure enough, you will get a character like Mona Chang. But also, because of my working method and the kind of character and the kind of liveness that I'm looking for, it will also tell us something, and see, this is very interdependent, about the context, because it is the world in herself, because I start with a nerve, which has to do with the context, something about the context. So it, you know, people sort of say, well, how did you write this? You know, this is all about, you know, this is a meta-ethnic book. It's all about the nature of ethnicity, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I can see that that's all true. You know, I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You know, I read all the books, and I can see that's true. And it seems to them kind of this brilliant thing, which I have managed to take this theory and put it on the page. And the theory is there, and I'm not gonna, and the intellectual scaffolding is there. But the reason it's there is because of my working method, which is actually highly intuitive, and it does not start from the books. It starts from within. I think that every serious writer is in some zone where they are in control, but they're not in control. And because they are in that zone, they are writing things which are a secret to themselves. And so, and as you go on, you know, and sometimes you don't see it even till the end of the book. And at the end of the book, you will say, whoa, look at that, you know? And one thing I will say about Tiger writing is that it was very interesting to me. I mean, I would never have written this book of nonfiction had I not been asked to write it. But because I was asked to write it, I discovered, actually, that could happen in nonfiction, too. This is not a book where, you know, I planned it all and I just pushed execute and it just happened. This is a book where I was very much involved in the writing process and feeling my way forward. And as I felt my way forward, I came to a place that I did not even know existed and I did not know was mine.
I'm Richard Walensky. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And my guest is Gish Jen. When you say you did not know it was mine, that almost seems as if for the person growing up in the independent society, mm-hmm. which you basically did, even if your parents weren't living in that world, the interdependent elements, mm-hmm. the elements that talk about the societal forces,
yes.
you would see those second pass because they would be there, but they'd be more unconscious.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And then there's something about the process of writing where, you know, things come from the unconscious, the subconscious, and then they arrive in the conscious realm. And at that moment, you think, oh.
And, yeah, they are.
You know, well, it's just the way we wake up and we've had some dream and suddenly realize, oh, you know, I really don't like that guy.
Right.
Right? I mean, I have been sounding kind of suppressing, but now I really don't like him, you know, or something like that. And then once in the conscious realm, yes, of course, we do use another part of our brain. And, you know, and we do say, wow, you know, I had that feeling, but you know, I wonder if this is related to things that many people were feeling in 1968, you know, as opposed to, you know, 1978. For these reasons, I can actually read books about it, and you know, and then things start to come together in an intellectual way.
Well, you just said something about part of your brain, and suddenly it occurred to me, is what we're talking about what some people call left brain, right brain?
There's a kind of correlation. You know, again, I hesitate a little bit to say that because, I mean, I haven't seen any studies. And the reason I did that is because culture is so slippery and so fraught. And, you know, and I wanted to be able to have, you know, a real conversation about it, which is not just, you know, in my experience. It's, you know, in my experience. And also, we haven't had the study. I mean, anyway, I don't have any studies, left brain, right brain studies exactly, although my gut tells me that there's a connection.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about another topic that may or may not be related. You could bring it back, but it's something that appears in all of your novels, and it wouldn't surprise me if it was in most of your short stories and everything you've written, which is the nature of identity politics. You know, there was a time when we needed identity politics in the 60s and 70s, as you know. When assimilationism suddenly was replaced by this is where I came from.
Right.
would be the interdependent way of saying it, or this is who I am, which would be the independent way of saying it. Here we are now, 40 years later. How strong should those elements be in how we view the world or how we view our own politics? What do you think?
I think that in America, it is a great gift to be able to make yourself. And I think that, that's a very independent thing to say. But I think that I don't think anyone should tell you how to make yourself. By the same token, you know, I think that one of the things that's I think is clear about my book is that to be an Asian American is to be quite a complicated person, because you do bridge, you know, kind of two extreme cultures. And the voices that sort of said, you know, your truest self is your Asian self, boy, that's a tough thing to swallow. And so I guess that's to sort of say that I am simply not interested in being told what that means. I'm interested in discovering it for myself. I'm interested, you know, I spent a lot of time in Asia, so I am very interested, but I am interested in going there on my own steam for my own reasons. So there's a way in which it's interesting because I'm interested in responsibility, but I'm also interested in freedom. I would say, too, that, you know, finally, if I look at, you know, what I'm trying to do in a book like Tiger Writing, and what I've really tried to do in all my books, finally, the agenda has been liberatory.
If someone says to you, you are an Asian American writer, you are a writer, those two statements, do you feel any difference between the two statements, between saying that you're an Asian American novelist versus you're a novelist?
I think that very frequently when people are saying this, that I am an Asian American novelist, they have no idea what Asian American means. No. I don't. I don't think they understand. They frequently do not understand what Asia is, and they frequently do not understand what an Asian American is. And so to the degree to which this is like a kind of a convenient, you know, this is a label, and that, you know, it brings certain assumptions about what I, quote unquote, should be writing about. Obviously, I reject that. I think I can write whatever I want to write about. And of course, as you know, I mean, I've written about farmers, and I've written about Jews, and I've written about African Americans, and I will continue to write about whomever I want to write about. I'll continue to write whatever it is that I have to say. So I guess the degree to which Asian American means somebody who might have a particular feeling for culture or interest in cultural difference, that probably describes me. You know, I think that I am obsessed with culture and kind of larger frameworks. And I do think that that has to do with my Asian roots. So, you know, I'm not going to reject that. But I think I do reject Asian American when it simply means that, for instance, that I'm about identity politics. Because nothing could be farther from the truth. As a writer, any label that would somehow diminish my ability to express myself, you know, whatever that means, I would reject that.
I want to go back to your original decision to become a writer. Now, you'd been writing anyway on your own, right? Or not?
I was actually very, very late coming to writing.
Really?
Yeah. Because, you know, I was a nice Chinese girl, the daughter of immigrants. You know, I was not encouraged to write. I grew up with very few books. In fact, my godmother would send me a book every Christmas. So I had a copy of Heidi, and I had a copy of Little Women. We would go to the public library probably twice a year. So, you know, I did not grow up with books. And I attended a Catholic school that had a donation library. It was quite a pathetic affair. I mean, there were books on lawn care in it. And I read through it in about 5 minutes. I remember very clearly when I got to Scarsdale, New York. We moved there when I was in fifth grade, and they had a real library, you know. I read everything in it. And I guess, you know, looking back, you know, maybe, you know, if this were my child, you know, and I saw them reading like that, and I saw that they were, you know, that they could write, I mean, probably I would immediately have said, oh, my goodness, this child's going to be a writer. But no one ever said anything even slightly like that to me, and my creative writing was not in any way encouraged. changed. I mean, I did write a story for my fifth grade. We had a little school magazine, and I do remember writing a story for that on mimeographed paper. It was all about a maid who had stolen some money and had hidden it inside a hat. When I picked up the hat, the money fell out. So, you know, I was interested in writing, but I did not write the first thing that I would call an actual kind of creative piece until I was a junior in college, which is quite late. And I did it really by accident. And what happened was I took a course in prosody and verse form with Robert Fitzgerald, the translator, wonderful man. He said there was going to be a weekly exercise. I thought he meant a paper, but it turned out it was a weekly exercise in verse. And I thought, well, I can't do that. But I said, well, but I'll try it. And if I can't do it, I'll just drop the course. The first exercise was in Catullan Henniger syllables, something I can hardly say today. You know, right away, I loved it. And I told a roommate of mine, I said, you know, I love this. If I could do this for the rest of my life, I would. But, you know, I was a daughter of people like me to become writers. I had never met a writer. I really had no idea how one would go about doing that. But Fitzgerald was the first person to say to me, he said, you know, you have a way with words. Why are you pre-med? But, of course, I had also just gotten a C in chemistry, so his question was well-timed. And in case, you know, so slowly, I will say that, you know, I kind of became a writer eventually, really by process of elimination. I was pre-med, I was pre-law, I was actually in Stanford Business School when I took my first real writing classes. I was there at Stanford Business School. I was supposed to be taking business classes. I never went to class. I only went to this writing class I was taking across the street. And kind of slowly, I began to accept, I guess, as Grace Paley once told me, that this was my fate. By the time I finally accepted, you know, I was well into my 30s.
Well, at that point, were you working?
I dropped out of business school. I went to China for a year. And I came back and I applied to the Iowa Writers Workshop.
Pretty much everyone knows if you go into Iowa, you're going to wind up a writer.
I still had some bumps after that. You know? I mean, I would like to, you know, it's one of these things, you know, talk about somebody, you know, who has to write a long way in order to discover the obvious. For whatever reason, you know, I was very slow to really embrace it. And in fact, the first time I called myself a writer, I was at the Bunting Institute at Radcliffe, and I remember I was the youngest fellow, and we went around the circle identifying ourselves, and they got to me, and I said that I was a would-be writer. And they said, you can't, and it's all these senior women, you can't say that, say you're a writer. And so I know that the very first time I said I was a writer was in that circle, and really I was just shamed into it.
How many novels did you write or try to write before you finally got that Typical American published?
No, Typical American was my first novel.
Oh, cool.
I did start it, the circle I just described was on Monday of being at the Bunting Institute, and I started Typical American on Friday. Before I had gotten to the Bunting Institute, the word novel had never crossed my mind. I had never even dreamt that I could do such a thing. But such was the climate of expectation but by Friday I thought, I'm going to write a novel. The first line came to me right then. It's an American story. And I did write it, you know, straight through. I finished exactly 4 years later as if I was on the academic calendar. It was very interesting. I finished it on graduation day at Harvard. It was very startling. Wow. To realize that I'd finished my novel and that I went outside and people were walking around, with the regalia on. And it was kind of a funny moment.
And at that point, you found an agent and sold it? Or
people had been writing to me as I was writing, and I simply took all their names. I said, I'm so sorry, I'm writing now, and I don't really talk to anybody, but I'll put your name in a file. And so when I was done, I looked in my folder, and I contacted all the people who had written to me, and then I went to New York, and then I picked one, and then they sold my book. And so I was a very late starter. For me, the internal battle was the largest battle. And then once I dealt with myself, the rest of the world was a piece of cake.
A lot of people have trouble with the second novel just simply because they've written one and then now what?
I knew that I had to write about Mona because she was such a big presence in Typical American. She had kind of a life of her own, too much life almost. And so I did sort of think, you know, there's another novel in this person. Let me set it aside and that will be my second novel. And so I kind of knew. It's interesting how she came to me. The world of Mona came to me. I had gone to give a reading in the Village in New York, and the person taking tickets was from my high school, and I hadn't seen her for many years. But when she was in high school, she used to like to lift her shirt up and kind of flash it at people. And here it was, you know, X years later, and she lifted her shirt up and flashed her belly. And that gesture is not in my book, but something just seeing her do that, you know, this whole world came back to me. And I did also make note of that. And I thought, oh, and I know what the world will be. And I guess the third element was, you know, I kept these note cards then, you know, and any kind of idea I had, I would write on these note cards. And then I would flip through them if I was trying to start a new project. And one of those note cards said, Mona turns Jewish. And I saw that card and I started laughing. And then I thought, oi, can't write that. And then because of my working method, because I'm interested in the nerve, I thought, what is this laughter about? You know, why do I have this feeling that I can't write, you know, I can't write that? Is this a nerve that I have developed as a result of my contact with the world? And sure enough, it was a nerve. It was a big nerve. It's funny. It's a little bit like this when I was just talking about the protagonist of Story of the Stone, who so flies in the face of all the Confucian expectations. I did know that at that moment, it was a highly politically correct time, I knew that this was the one novel I should not be writing. You know, I knew that it was not time to write, I'm Chinese and I'm Jewish. It was time, you know, it's time to write, I'm Chinese and I'm proud, right? Instead, I wrote, I'm Chinese and I'm Jewish, damn it. And I guess I didn't think, oh, that's a great idea. But what I knew was that was me.
You've been listening to an interview with Gish Jen, whose latest book is Tiger Writing, Art, Culture, and the Interdependent Self.
Now, this seems like a perfect point at which to resume our reading of Walden, which we left off in show 646. This is chapter 5, speaking about solitude. Now, just as Jill Bolte Taylor, after her stroke, talked about moving the seat of consciousness to the right brain, the connected self, is Henry David Thoreau perhaps engaging in meditation? And is that what allows him to feel at one with nature to the extent that he wonders whether the individual self is just a modern fiction, whether he shouldn't consider that he is a part of everyone and everything around him?
With thinking, we may be beside ourselves in a sane sense. By a conscious effort of the mind, we can stand aloof from actions and their consequences, and all things, good and bad, go by us like a torrent. We are not wholly involved in nature. I may be either the driftwood in the stream, or Indra in the sky looking down on it. I may be affected by a theatrical exhibition. On the other hand, I may not be affected by an actual event which appears to concern me much more. I only know myself as a human entity, the scene, so to speak, of thoughts and affections, and am sensible of a certain doubleness by which I can stand as remote from myself as from another. However intense my experience, I am conscious of the presence and criticism of a part of me, which, as it were, is not a part of me, but spectator, sharing no experience, but taking note of it. And that is no more I than it is you. When the play, it may be the tragedy, of life is over, the spectator goes his way. It was a kind of fiction, a work of the imagination only, so far as he was concerned. This doubleness may easily make us poor neighbors and friends sometimes. I find it wholesome to be alone the greater part of the time. To be in company, even with the best, is soon wearisome and dissipating. I love to be alone. I never found the companion that was so companionable as solitude. We are for the most part more lonely when we go abroad among men than when we stay in our own chambers. A man thinking or working is always alone, let him be where he will. Solitude is not measured by the miles of space that intervene between a man and his fellows. The really diligent student in one of the crowded hives of Cambridge College is as solitary as a dervish in the desert. The farmer can work alone in the field or the woods all day, hoeing or chopping, and not feel lonesome, because he is employed. But when he comes home at night, he cannot sit down in a room alone, at the mercy of his thoughts, but must be where he can see the folks, and recreate, and, as he thinks, remunerate himself for his day's solitude. And hence, he wonders how the student can sit alone in the house all night and most of the day without ennui and the blues. But he does not realize that the student, though in the house, is still at work in his field and chopping in his woods as the farmer in his, and in turn seeks the same recreation and society that the latter does, though it may be a more condensed form of it. Society is commonly too cheap. We meet at very short intervals, not having had time to acquire any new value for each other. We meet at meals 3 times a day and give each other a new taste of that old, musty cheese that we are. We have had to agree on a certain set of rules, called etiquette and politeness, to make this frequent meeting tolerable, and that we need not come to open war. We meet at the post office, and at the sociable, and about the fireside every night. We live thick, and are in each other's way, and stumble over one another, and I think that we thus lose some respect for one another. Certainly less frequency would suffice for all important and hearty communications. Consider the girls in a factory, never alone, hardly in their dreams. It would be better if they were but one inhabitant to a square mile, as where I live. The value of a man is not in his skin, that we should touch him. I have heard of a man lost in the woods and dying of famine and exhaustion at the foot of a tree, whose loneliness was relieved by the grotesque visions with which, owing to bodily weakness, his diseased imagination surrounded him, and which he believed to be real. So also, owing to bodily and mental health and strength, we may be continually cheered by a like but more normal and natural society, and come to know that we are never alone. I have a great deal of company in my house, especially in the morning, when nobody calls. Let me suggest a few comparisons, that someone may convey an idea of my situation. I am no more lonely than the loon in the pond that laughs so loud, or than Walden Pond itself. What company has that lonely lake, I pray. And yet it has not the blue devils, but the blue angels in it, in the azure tint of its waters. The sun is alone, except in thick weather when there sometimes appear to be two, but one is a mock sun. God is alone, but the devil, he is far from being alone. He sees a great deal of company. He is legion. I am no more lonely than a single mullein, or dandelion in a pasture, or a bean leaf, or a sorrel, or a horsefly, or a bumblebee. I am no more lonely than the mill brook, or a weathercock, or the north star, or the south wind, or an April shower, or a January thaw, or the first spider in a new house. I have occasional visits in the long winter evenings, when the snow falls fast and the wind howls in the wood, from an old settler and original proprietor who is reported to have dug Walden Pond and stoned it and fringed it with pine woods, who tells me stories of old time and new eternity, and between us we manage to pass a cheerful evening with social mirth and pleasant views of things, even without apples or cider. A most wise and humorous friend, whom I love much, who keeps himself more secret than ever did Gough or Whaley, and though he is thought to be dead, none can show where he is buried. An elderly dame, too, dwells in my neighborhood, invisible to most persons, in whose odorous herb garden I love to stroll sometimes, gathering simples and listening to her fables, for she has a genius of unequaled fertility, and her memory runs back farther than mythology, and she can tell me the original of every fable, and on what fact every one is founded, for the incidents occurred when she was young. A ruddy and lusty old dame, who delights in all weathers and seasons, and is likely to outlive all her children yet. The indescribable innocence and beneficence of nature, of sun and wind and rain, of summer and winter, such health, such cheer they afford forever, and such sympathy have they ever with our race, that all nature would be affected, and the sun's brightness fade, and the winds would sigh humanely, and the clouds rain tears, and the woods shed their leaves, and put on mourning in midsummer, if any man should ever for a just cause grieve. Shall I not have intelligence with the earth? Am I not partly leaves and vegetable mould myself? What is the pill which keeps us well, serene, contented? Not my or thy great-grandfathers, but our great-grandmother nature's universal, vegetable, botanic medicines, by which she has kept herself young always, outlived so many old pars in her day, and fed her health with their decaying fatness. For my panacea, instead of one of those quack vials of a mixture dipped from Acheron and the Dead Sea, which come out of those long, shallow, black schooner-looking wagons which we sometimes see made to carry bottles, let me have a draught of undiluted morning air. Morning air! If men will not drink of this at the fountainhead of the day, why then, We must even bottle up some and sell it in the shops for the benefit of those who have lost their subscription ticket to morning time in this world. But remember, it will not keep quite till noonday, even in the coolest cellar, but drive out the stopples long ere that, and follow westward the steps of Aurora. I am no worshipper of Hygieia, who was the daughter of that old herb-doctor Aesculapius, and who is represented on monuments holding a serpent in one hand, and in the other a cup, out of which the serpent sometimes drinks, but rather of Hebe, cup-bearer to Jupiter, who was the daughter of Juno and wild lettuce, and who had the power of restoring gods and men to the vigor of youth. She was probably the only thoroughly sound-conditioned, healthy, and robust young lady that ever walked the globe, and wherever she came, it was spring.
I went to the Yalakum, where the Fraser River runs, and the mountains cannot be undone, those great bodies of breathing in their cold, clean air, I felt as if they cared, and I then fell silent in their stare, those great bodies of nature. I went out in the western night and gazed into the giant.
There with Michael Holt's Great Bodies of Nature on the album The Dawn Chorus. This show and all previous episodes are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
Just like